Got a lot of people out again. I'll just say this. If you listen to this online, or if you're later listening to this online, this will not make a lot of sense if you're not here. So I don't do things based off what people are going to hear later online. There's not really a good way to do this, but there's a lot of charts, and I think this makes more sense if you see it. So if you're listening, there'll be some words, and hopefully it'll make some sense, but we've got a bunch of visuals here that people are seeing that I think will make more sense of the words. We are looking at skepticism and doubt, and we will later hit the hiddenness of God and certainty and uncertainty, and a lot of people were wrestling with these kind of things, and so we're taking time to discuss them. The first week we talked about the good of not knowing, that there's actually an element of humanity that we gain by not having everything downloaded and everything answered. On the second week, we looked at other gifts that uncertainty will provide us if we allow them to. The third week, I think, was pivotal. So if you've been gone, that one might be a good one to listen to, where we ask some philosophical questions. How much do you and I really know? And we offered that this is a much more level playing field than people like to admit. So the media, people sometimes out in the world, will act like they have science and facts, and people in here believe in prayer and miracles and a man in the sky, and so they think that they're different. But we've said much more of a level playing field, that none of us have 100% unquestionable certainty about really anything. The best we can have is a relative amount of certainty, which leaves a relative amount of uncertainty, which actually leaves room for and requires faith. So we all said, when it comes down to it, we all live by faith, and there's certainly different levels with that, but all of us live at some level by faith. And so the only question then last week was, if that's true, if we all live by faith, now the question is it good or bad? Is it something that is progressively moving you forward, causing you to be more loving, active, a better human being in the world, or is it something that is stagnant and decaying and pulls you backwards, actually makes you worse? Or does it matter? If you didn't hold this belief, you would still live the same. There's a difference between good and bad faith. And we ended with this. I thought this was important to bring up with again. We ended with this chart, where circle A is all truth and nothing but the truth. So help us God. That's what God knows. And all those other circles are maybe other churches, denominations within Christianity, or we could even say other world religions and perspectives. And notice some of them touch on each other. They cover some of the same material. Some are very far apart and different. But we said to have good faith. I think there's a difference between having faith in my circle and having faith in the big circle, which I think is admittedly beyond us. There's a significant difference between having faith in my religion, maybe that's way over here, this bigger one near A. There's a big difference between having faith in my religion, my belief system, my denomination, my church, my current understanding and worldview of things, and we could say faith in God's religion, the way God sees and knows and understands the world. There's a difference there. Now, good faith has no choice to be at a circle. As human beings, we've got to define it. I always like this, that we use sometimes say in church, don't put God in a box. Now, here's the thing. As human beings, we have nothing but a box. We have to define God somehow, but leave the lid open. See? So don't shut the lid, because there's more. There's expansiveness there, so keep it open. So we have no choice to be a circle, to define ourselves in some way, but hopefully we do it with humility and curiosity and openness to correction and a hunger. This is where I sometimes feel us missing in religion, a hunger for growth, instruction, and learning so that we grow in deeper love for God and others. Let me just say this to close it out. If we fail to recognize that when we say God, that term God, or when we define our religion, our understanding of the world, whatever that box looks like, if we don't realize that that always falls short of which it is supposed to point towards, then I think what happens, we begin to worship our conceptual creations that come from ourself. That's the, remember the video we saw last week, that's the certainty of idolatry. So we begin to, it's our ideas and understanding of God that we sometimes are worship rather than bowing before the one who stands over and above that creation. So that's huge. So we're back to this. So we leave the world of certainty and uncertainty for a while, and hopefully, if you listen to these in a row, they kind of make sense, like chapters in a book. And so we've moved from certainty, uncertainty, to now talking about faith. Everybody has it. Everybody lives by it. Is it good or bad? And now we just want to look at the nature of faith and really, oftentimes, why we don't like it. Probably all of us have been here before, standing in front of a map that says you are here, and those can be helpful. Maps are tools that reveal your current position in light of the desired destination you want to get to. And it allows you to plot a course. They're helpful because it highlights known referent points for you along the way. Not people that are not here tonight, they're the ones that have the babies. I was going to say not a lot of you though, but a lot of people here have had babies recently in the past year. And when you have babies, there's all these books you can get from Barnes and Nobles that tell you what is typical for each month of that baby's life. And I think those books are good because parents can say, well, my kid's 3 months above what he's supposed to be able to do. But we map human growth. And I think what people often miss is that we can map spiritual growth. One of the most popular is the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of the most recognized. It's this ladder, it's the steps, it's this progression towards wholeness, moving away from addiction and that which holds us back. One of the most ancient schemes was written by John Climacus called the Ladder of Divine Ascent. That's one of the more older ones, and he actually had, that's a lot, but he had 30 distinct Christian stages, and it all ended, the goal was, it culminated in the life of love. That's what he mapped out. Now, from his, there became this much shorter, what we would call the classic pattern of growth that was used in the church. It's still used today. That looks like four, but really the awakening is like, okay, well, you have to have an awakening. But the three steps used most often in the ancient church were purgation, illumination, and union. So think of, you have an awakening, you turn to Christ. There's a period of time like your garage where there is cobwebs and it is dirty and you have too much stuff. So it's a time of purging, putting away all that is old, cleaning up, throwing away things that need to be thrown away. And as you purge, now the windows are clean so the light of Christ can shine through. Things are illuminated that were once in the dark. And the goal of that is always union, a deeper union with Christ, where you live in that union, and you function out of that union. That's the goal. Now, St. John of the Cross, he put his mark on this by saying, oh, hold on, it's not that easy. There seems to be this moment in the spiritual life where you have a dark night of the soul, where things that were easy, things that were in the light are now darker. It's not as easy. A lot of times pain comes into your life. The loss of a loved one comes into your life. Cancer comes into your life. And all of a sudden, those easy answers don't make as much sense. And God seems to pull away, quite frankly. Those dark moments, sometimes he seems further away or seems to be hiding. We'll get to that later in this series. But he added this idea of the dark night of the soul. And other writers have different ways. So there's that purgation, illumination, union. I like this one. A writer said, look, it's kind of like simplicity, complexity, perplexity, and humility. So when you first come to the faith, it's simple, it's easy. Man, you're walking with Jesus. Life is grand. And as you progress in discipleship, things become more complex. It's a lot deeper than you had originally imagined. And then there comes those Job moments in life where now it's perplexing. It doesn't even seem to make sense anymore. But the goal, see, notice, what I love about these is the goal is always to push forward because there's reaching this level of humility. It's always the life of love, humility, deeper union with God, so that there's a point. And one author said, this one's okay to me, but he said it's like an initial orientation into the faith, which eventually in your life will often become a painful disorientation. But see, the goal is never to end there. That's where a lot of people walk away from the faith, right there in those moments. The goal is joyful reorientation back in. So these are helpful because what faith maps do is they help us recognize the need for further spiritual growth, but also that there is potential. We're not satisfied where we're at. We're working out our salvation. So there is potential for greater levels, greater growth. Living things grow. There's a difference between existence and being alive. Scriptures say it like this. It's all over the scriptures. Your faith is greatly enlarged. 2 Corinthians talks about as your faith grows. As to the love of the brethren, excel even more. The love of each of you toward one another grows ever greater. Increase and abound in love for one another and for all men. Grow up into all aspects into him. Christ is being formed in you. You ought to walk and please God and excel still more at that. Grow in respect to salvation. Grow in the grace of the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. Sprinkled all over the New Testament. This is the Spirit's work in our life, and we're called to this synergy, this cooperation with how God is at work. So you work out your salvation, and you do that because God is at work. And God is at work, and so you work out your salvation. So it's this great circle. I think it's what Paul meant when he said we move from one degree of a glory to another, or in 2 Corinthians, we're being renewed day by day. I've shown this before, but this will be one of the last faith maps here I show. There's two authors, wrote a great book called The Critical Journey. I think it's one of the better ones. And they help us understand and they help us navigate spiritual growth. What I like about this one is it incorporates insights from 2,000 years of Christian tradition into it. So it gives you a complete map, and I think it covers the highlights of the Christian journey. So think of it like this. This map is a picture of our spiritual journey, your response, your faith in God, with the resulting life changes that come from that. Because we would say faith in God is fluid, right? It's dynamic. Your experience of that is continual, and it's always expanding. So receiving God into our life, I would offer you, should start this continual process of growth rather than some point of arrival. See, too often in the church, it's like we want to get people in the kingdom, we want to get people saved, but that's you've just crossed the starting point, and you're now in a race. So it's this continual process of growth rather than a point of arrival. And what we know about spiritual growth is it isn't instant, and it isn't easy. So therefore, it doesn't fit well with our culture. It's not instant, it's not easy. It's a journey, and the journey involves process and action and movement and change and starts and stops and variety of all sorts and even surprises. So the authors here, they're just trying to describe the various phases of the journey and trying to illustrate for us how people might think and act when they are in these various phases. And you might start off at a different point. I mean, I think we all start with some kind of discovery or recognition of God, but you might cycle back through these stages and they might even be deeper for you as you circle back. But I'll bring up the first three. The first three look like this. The first three stages are more of an external thing. It's more outward. You find an institution. You have a leader. You have a book. You have principles that kind of teach you the discipline, the disciple life. And then the next three stages are kind of an internal thing. They're harder, a little bit harder to describe. But the first three, they're pretty obvious. There's this discovery and recognition of God. So in that stage, you recognize God, you hear the gospel, you become a Christian. Again, everything is wild. Like, boy, you see things through that lens. It's wonderfully wild and happy and joyous, and everything is butterflies and roses. The second one, then, is the life of discipleship. If we do this thing well, then we say, okay, that's great. That's the starting point. Here's what the life of following Jesus looks like. And then it might even say, by the third step, now we say, now here's an outlet for all those things that you've learned about being a disciple of Jesus. Now, most of evangelicalism is summed up in those first three stages. Sometimes that is the climax of the spiritual growth. So the goal and the pinnacle is to be a mature, faithful, committed follower of Jesus Christ, and you're using your gift in the church. But we all know this, people can have a productive life, but they can still be self-serving, legalistic, immature, and unhealed inwardly, right? So it can look great, and we've come from that, where it's like, oh, this is the real, this is what a good Christian looks like. They're always busy, they're in Bible studies, they're doing this, they're like, yeah, okay. But there's a lot maybe not being healed inwardly. Here's what's not often described, then, is the journey inward. Most people don't even have language for this, that there seems to be a type, it's a very deep and personal inward journey that usually always comes from some kind of painful experience and will result in healing for those who push through this. That is key. Many people, this is a dangerous step to come to because many people walk away from the church and the faith when they hit this. And you can understand why. I'm not even a judging moment for them. Some people lose someone close to them. Cancer comes into their life. Unmet expectations. Whatever it is, it sends you on this journey inward where it used to be easy, positive answers. And now you're exploring and questioning and even falling apart sometimes. And you're doubting and you're wallowing in the abstract philosophical. But now you become pretty self-oriented because you got to figure this thing out. What was so easy before now sounds very phony and cliche to you. It's not easy. Now, why does getting to that stage usually demand a crisis? Well, it's actually simple because no one chooses that kind of experience on their own. We don't naturally go there. This is much more comfortable on the tan side there or whatever. See, so most people aren't going to naturally, I've got to go further. No, I'm quite content and happy with these answers and my theology the way it is. Thank you very much. But some outside thing comes in and pressures you, and all of a sudden, now there's this deep introspection. And again, some people drop off the journey at this point. This is what St. John of the Cross meant. These authors call it the wall. You can't go over it or around it. You have to push through it. That's what St. John of the Cross meant when he talked about the dark night of the soul. And his point was, and here's the good news, is that then there's two other steps. See, if a person is willing, and here's what I think happens in the church. Some of you have said, man, I'm doubting. I don't know what I think anymore. I'm struggling. Here's the thing. Stay there. Don't run. Stage four is not a time to make any decision. Stay put. God does feel absent. There's reasons for that. And when the great saints of the past have said, actually, this is a normal stage. Like, if you want deep union with God, this is a stage that most people go through. Don't be scared of it. It's painful. It hurts. It can be very disorienting. But there's something on the other side if you can push through. So stage five is the journey outward. So think of that. You move from inward conflicts to a focus now outward to other people. And now you have a grounded center. You understand that God loves you, but before, it was performance-based. You're trying to do more and more and become busy and busy and get God's attention, but now you know God loves you exactly as you are, and you're okay with that. And you know you make mistakes, and you know you're a mess, and you know that you're not perfect, and yet that's the exact kind of people that God uses. You understand that. And then stage six is that union with God, deeper union, the life of love, the life of humility, where you are at one with God. You function and operate out of that. So let me say this, we can move on. These faith maps, I think, and I'll bring these up. See, this is how other authors have said some of the same things. You see simplicity and complexity there on that side, and then perplexity, and it leads to communion, or the old saints, purgation, illumination, the dark night of the soul, and deeper union. You can kind of see them all together there. These faith maps help us understand that stages are normal. So for those who come to stage four and they're experiencing all these doubts and all these frustration, it feels like they might be abandoning God and abandoning the faith, but sometimes your faith is being enriched. Sometimes you are rediscovering your faith. So to me, it's very helpful to know that this is a normal, necessary step on the journey of love. The point is, can we hang in? Can we hang on when we're at one of those stage four experiences? The fact is, growth is painful. Ask any teenager moving to adulthood about growing pains. Growth comes at a price. This is why the church, sometimes the church is all about, you know, cheerleading for to get everybody excited on Sunday, but it takes more than enthusiasm. See, it takes commitment, it takes determination, it takes perseverance. We all desire to grow really rapidly, but hearing of these difficulties and what we have to push through, sometimes that helps us curb those desires to move too quickly. Like teenagers, they just want to move quickly to adulthood. No, this takes time. Maturity takes time and experience. There's no quick fix. There's no quick pill that we can take to have a deep, intimate relationship with God. Think of it, instant intimacy. That's like an oxymoron. It doesn't work. Just like human relationships, deeper trust and intimacy tend to only happen through trials and struggles and periods of doubt. So the critical journey helps us because it reveals that real growth comes through, unfortunately, this crucible of suffering. Now again, a lot of evangelicals, a lot of times ways that we've been in the church, they climax at three, if they're good. If we get you in the church, serving in the church, using your gift, we're gravy. But church work isn't always an indicator of maturity. Busyness doesn't always lead to automatic spiritual growth. Matter of fact, the opposite is true sometimes. Busyness can be just a mask that we put on, but the church primarily focuses on stage 1, 2, and 3 because that's what we know. That's what we can control. So the question becomes, what does it mean to be the church, or how does the church relate to people that move beyond stage 3? So many people leave the church when they go through that journey inward or stage 4 because they hit that wall and there's so few resources or programs, or a lot of times the church doesn't know what to do with them, so they feel alienated. They feel like they can't sit in a service and say the creed in the same way that, so they feel alienated from the faith. And many who've left the church haven't lost faith in God. They lost faith in the church. Church didn't know what to do with them. Oh, you're doubting. Oh, hard times come into your life and you're canning the faith. Whoa, you know. So they look elsewhere to meet their deepest spiritual needs. I would say for some, the church was stunting their spiritual growth. Think of that. So the church that is there to enrich you and push you forward, to be your mother, to guide you into truth, actually can become a place that stunts your growth because it doesn't know, it doesn't even know that those exist, doesn't know its own history or tradition. So maybe the church should take some of those criticisms very seriously because maybe we have a weak spot. Like maybe there's a stunted model of spiritual formation that doesn't leave room for questions or doubts or rediscovery. I would offer maybe the stunted growth of the evangelical church comes from a stunted model of spiritual formation. That we haven't listened to those who've come before us and say, actually, one of the most normal steps on there is this time where you go into a dark period. That's normal. That's somewhat needed to lead the life of love and to grow deeper with God. We all say we want to grow deeper, and I think the church is coming to you saying, it often looks like this in some form or another. These aren't just perfect. You might come in at a different point, but you get the gist. So that leads us to tonight, Scott Peck. There he is, in all of his glory, M. Scott Peck. He's written about the stages of human spiritual development as well, and his point is obviously people are not at all at the same place spiritually. That's why he wrote this. There seems to be some kind of pattern of progression, no matter how you would name it, through identifiable stages in the human spiritual life. So I want to use his, I don't think his is even the best. I think I like the critical journey the best. So I don't think his the best, but for this week, so that it can lead us into next week, because we're talking about faith and the nature of faith and why we don't like it. And one of the reasons we don't like it is faith demands mystery. And that bothers a lot, like even for some people to hear, like, oh no, I thought faith was to lead to greater understanding. No, it demands mystery. And so to understand that more this week, I want to look at his. He has four stages of human spiritual development. And the first one is this. Stage 1 is chaotic and antisocial. So he says this. We all start with this underdeveloped sense of spirituality. So whether you grow up in an atheist home where God is never discussed and you don't know anything of the church, or you grow up in a Christian home and as far as you can remember, you've been in Sunday school in the church, we all still start with an underdeveloped sense. You might start at a different level, but there's this underdeveloped sense until you take the faith on yourself. And so he uses the word chaotic because he's saying nothing governs us except our desires and our preferences. You know, our own chaos. So our will is driven exclusively to self-gratifying ways because there's no greater principle, teaching, moral person that we submit to. And then he uses the word antisocial because he says we're generally incapable of genuinely loving other people. We may look loving on the outside. We may think that we love other people, but our relationships tend to be manipulative and self-serving. Like, we love others in order to love ourselves. You know, We love other people for what they do for us, for how we feel when we're around them, what they can offer for us. So it isn't this kind of self-serving love. Now, obviously, we know this. Children start here, right? Anybody that's had children, you know this well. But a great percentage of adults stay here. That's scary. A good percentage stay here. Now, what happens sometimes in stage one, people wake up, something happens, and they wake up to the chaos of their inner lives, and usually, again, it's because of some kind of painful experience, such as life. But you wake up to this chaos, and you then begin to progress to the next stage. The next stage is what he would call formal and institutional. Now, hang with me, because I think this will make some sense to you, maybe even in your own life. People will run from the chaos of their inner lives by turning to something outside of them that gives them meaning, significance, or purpose. So if you have that waking moment and you see this chaos in your life, there'll be something outside of you that says, that can give me some definition. So they will look for the comfort and the structure of an institution. For some people, that would be prison life. Some people, that would be the military. A lot of people, you know, you're 18, man, you're wild. Send them to the military. Some people, it's a career. They pour themselves into their career, and they try to climb the corporate ladder. A lot of people, it is some kind of religion that they look to. That's why he uses the word institutional. People will look to something outside of themselves, some structure outside of themselves that now speaks into their lives, that gives them some guidance and some leadership. But he also calls this stage formal, and this is key. Because many people in this stage become attached to the forms, not the essence of a religion. That's key. Or whatever they turn to. I'm using religion specifically. Whatever they turn to for help in governing their life. Even military. I become addicted to, I get up at this time and I run at this time and the sergeant says that. See, you can become addicted to the forms and not the essence, what it's really about. So think of this. In religion, we become attached to the liturgy, the styles, the methods of the institution. Because in our mind, it is those forms that are responsible for our exodus, our liberation from that internal chaos, right? So we become very defensive when the forms are changed. Anybody ever been to church? So you become a Christian, you hear the gospel, you become a follower of Jesus, you're in this church, and you become, boy, that saved you, there's no doubt. To have those people speak in your life, to have that style of preaching, to have that kind of liturgy, those songs, the structure this way, there's no questioning, it brings great meaning. But you can become addicted to the form, not the essence. So M. Scott Pack, he says this, many and most churchgoers fall into this category. And people in this stage, man, I hope this for me, I hope something's going to start clicking with you here in a minute. People in this stage tend to view God as this external, transcendent being. So God is up there and God is out there, and they don't have a very good sense of immanence, that God is close. They would tell you that God is loving because what else can we say? But they also believe that God is there to punish those who break the rules. He's the big police officer in the sky, because that psychologically is what they need. You see, there's been nothing but chaos. They lived for themselves. They satisfied their own desires. Then they came to this and they saw a whole new world is the pearl of great price. And man, they love it, but they've now become addicted to the form and not the essence. And so it's a dangerous thing. Any kind of change, boy, that rattles them. Oh, my whole world, I'm going to have to skip churches. We create a theology that focuses on God as far away. See, it's easy to say God's holy. He's out there, and he's sovereign. He controls us, which very quickly turns into maybe a distant, angry God who punishes his son because he's detached from us, and he doesn't like our sin. You see that? We create kind of a juvenile theology at that point because we like to keep God. Religion likes to keep God at a distance. We like him, but we like him there. Don't tell me how close he is and how much he loves me. I don't need to hear how much he loves me. I need to know that he's mad at my sin and my wrongdoing. See, so stability for the people at this stage is a principal value. Like, oh, just keep things the way they are. But over time, many people begin to internalize the principles and the practices of that religion, and they find themselves becoming less dependent on the institution for leadership. So after a while, they hear what the church is saying. They've done it for years. They're living that productive life. They're using their gift in the church, and they've internalized everything the church has said, but it's coming easy for them now, and they don't necessarily need the leadership of the institution. So some will begin to question the forms and the institution that brought about their original deliverance. You see? And so they begin to move to stage three, which he calls skeptical and individual. So people who enter this door, they begin to question that institution and the forms that had previously brought them, what? Comfort and stability. So this used to be great and it works, but now I've taken this and it's like I need more. Often people at this stage are thought of as unbelievers. That's sad. A lot of times people that go through stage four, we almost cast them out or push them to the side and say they're losing the faith. They don't have it anymore, whereas they're not at all. Matter of fact, Scott Peck says people in this stage are generally more spiritually developed than many who stay content to stay in stage two. See, so over here it can look comfortable and you have all the right answers, but Scott, at least in his version, says sometimes the people going beyond that and questioning and doubting are more spiritually developed than those who just stay comfortably where they are at. Now, he uses the word individualistic because they're less inclined to just accept the authority of an institution. They're more desirous to find out for themselves, what is it that I really believe? I remember I was a youth pastor going, I'm not sure right at this moment if you pin me down, I believe Jesus is the Son of God. I've got to start there. I've got to start afresh. And I had to do that. And it was uncomfortable. Trust me. It was not fun. I remember clearly one morning standing up and about 150 youth are looking at me and I'm thinking in my head, I'm not sure right at this moment that I believe in Jesus. I'm going to preach my way through this and I'm not going to scare them or put them on this, but inside I was doubting. Now, individualistic though doesn't mean antisocial. It can mean that, but they a lot of times could be deeply committed to other people and to causes, but right now they're really wrestling with their worldview. They're wrestling with what's going on inside of them. And so they're much more skeptical than people in stage two. They question things. They tend to make up their own minds. They're active truth seekers. And if they keep asking and seeking and knocking and push through that, a lot of times, if we allow them, they will look back and say stage two beliefs weren't all that bad. See, what happens is they move from stage two and they go, oh, we're all going, oh, man, these people are doubt, they're losing their faith. No, not necessarily. Sometimes they have to deconstruct, and so they seem angry towards those old forms. Have any of you experienced that? You've been in other places, other churches, and now you're kind of angry with them for a while? That's normal. And if we allow that to be, and if we helped, instead of just deconstruction, there can be a reconstruction that looks back and say, you know what? That was a necessary part of my journey. Those moments were foundational, and I read these things and followed these people to get me to this point. So if we leave people alone and we have patience, sometimes they'll see there was something to those stage two beliefs, and then they might journey into this last stage. Stage four is what he calls mystical and communal. People at this stage, he calls it communal because they become aware of the underlining connectedness and the unity of all things and all people. In other words, they see human society as a whole instead of just separate political groups, antagonistic subsections of society. They see humanity as a whole. This is important, and this is what leads us into next week. He uses the word mystical because they are increasingly comfortable with mystery. Mystery. Mystics acknowledge the enormity of the unknown. They're okay with that. But rather than being frightened by it, they move deeper into it. See the difference there? They realize that the more they understand, the more they read, the more they begin to grasp things and put things together, actually the greater the mystery will become. That the goal is never to get and move past mystery. You know? People in this stage are actually attracted to mystery, which distinguishes them markedly from those in stage two. Does that make sense? Those in stage two, they need simple, clear-cut answers, dogmatic structures, and they have little appetite for the unknown or for that which is mysterious. We just don't, that's not where we're at. And Peck argues that people in stage four will enter into religion. Maybe they've walked away from the faith and they'll come back in, but they enter into religion and they look for church in order to approach mystery. But in stage two, people enter into religion to escape mystery. That's a deep insight. You got people who are coming to churches and they say, man, this world is big and boy, and the more I learn, the more my mind is blown, and so I need an outlet to worship. And other people are entering in the church because they want to escape from mystery. So think of that. You have people entering and participating in the same church, the same denomination, the same religion, but from totally opposite motives. Wow. So we'll end with this. Now, Peck would say, like all of these authors, that these four stages, there's variations. It's not just like you always follow a prayer. It's not meant to be just so concise that you have to go to this step and this step. You'll enter in at various stages. Some people may enter at stage three. They got a lot of questions. They're skeptical, but they find stage two to be more comfortable. And so they vacillate between two of those. He also points out that there exists a threat. Any of you ever experienced that? I have. There's a threat sometimes among people at different stages in their religious development. So if you're at a stage three, if you've been through something and you have questions, you now might become a threat to the institution. I don't know anybody like that. We tend to be mostly threatened by people in stages beyond us. Doesn't mean they're better. It just means something's probably happened in their life and they've moved to different stages. So you're not better because you're in stage four. You're different because you've gone through some things. So stage one people, you can see it up there. They are threatened by just about everything and everyone. You know, they may not look like it. They may look like they have everything together on the outside, but everything threatens their worldview because they're selfish. Stage two people view stage one people as what? Hopeless pagans. And a lot of times they're very threatened by people in stage three because those people are skeptical and they're doubting. They're like, are they going to lose the faith? And then they don't know what to do with people at stage four because those people seem to believe the same sort of things they do, but with a freedom and openness that just terrifies them. You see? And stage three people are intimidated by stage four people because they say, boy, I can ask my questions around these people and they're open and they're very thoughtful, but they still buy into all this God stuff. They're not deconstructing all the time and mad at the church all the time. So they don't know what to do with them. You see? So whether you agree with those statements, like that isn't the point at all. What is interesting is that people come to religious belief from one of two opposite perspectives, moving towards mystery or moving away from it. For some, again, the wonder, it's like childlike wonder, the mystery of human life, all that's going on in the world, man, it draws like, oh, I have to have faith. I have to believe that there's something more. And so they come into the church again because they need an outlet for worship. I need to just sing because everything can't be figured out. For other people, religion should offer clarity and answers to the big questions of life, and it should remove the mystery, not enforce it. See that? And I think a lot of Christians fall in that category, where Christianity is supposed to alleviate the mystery, the paradox, and the tension. Don't amplify it. Don't certainly don't magnify the mystery, you see? And we can all, I'm very sympathetic to that because I think at times we would all like our questions answered about, man, if you've dealt with suffering, if you've dealt with pain, you look out on the TV and see 59 people just enjoying life at a concert, and then bullets are flying, sound like a war zone. I would love those kind of questions to be answered in like 1 minute sound bites. It's easier to have three steps to knowing God's will than wrestling through the risk of making a decision and then trusting God for the results. It's far easier the other way. But God seems to have another agenda. And I gotta be honest, Some of you even that doubt and struggle, you're here. Maybe you're at a stage four. And this is where it's easy to give up, because I would offer you God does have another agenda. Now hear me, God speaks a clear and authoritative word in Jesus. You want to know what God is like? You want to know his heart and his mind? It looks like Jesus hanging on the cross. So the New Testament is about that. There was a mystery, and now the mystery has been revealed. So we know a lot, and we understand a lot when we look in the face of Jesus. At the same time, that impulse that drives us in chemistry, in astrophysics, and in a medicine to understand and to master our world, that's part of what it means to be a Genesis one person who's made in the image of God. That's the glory of human beings, to explore and to name and to tag and to create. Just like God separated and filled at the beginning, we're called to separate and fill and be like him. But that same mastery that drives us in other things, we tend to bring over into our theology, and we tend to force faith in God into categories and structures that by definition attempt to remove mystery and paradox and tension. It's a weird balance we live in. God calls you to love him with all of your heart, soul, and mind. Theology can be great. It can be helpful. God does speak to us, I think, through creation, through our conscience, through the scriptures, through preaching, through the sacraments, through the tradition of the church, through our experience, through other people. But often his speaking raises more questions than it answers. You look at every major Bible character, and what does God give them? More questions. And I'm honest with you, that frustrates me as well. You can, at that moment, either walk away or you can be drawn in. That's it. Like, sometimes we have these questions, God, Job, why? Where were you, Job? Do you understand this? Do you understand the symmetry of the planet I've created? No? Okay. There's a boundary. There's a tree. We'll either kneel before the tree or we'll try to take the fruit. We can walk away. It's the last overhead. There's my question for you to linger for a week. What if God is about deepening the mystery and not me removing it? I remember asking myself that, and I did not enjoy that when I came to that conclusion when I had my own struggles with the faith. That what if God isn't about removing? What if there's never a point you'll grasp this and be able to chart it and make complete sense of it? What if the further you walk with God, the deeper the mystery goes? Are you willing to follow? It's a question eventually we'll all have to answer. Like, that's for all of us. That isn't just for people down. Like, you'll come to that point in your life, and you'll have to ask, is God going to answer my questions? And if he doesn't, I'm going to be mad, and I'm going to pout, and I'm going to walk away. That's an understandable path. I don't even judge that. I understand that. I don't think it's the best, but I understand it. Or will you be able to say, God is about deepening, and the further I go, it becomes a deeper mystery. But that makes sense of life, right? Would life be simple? No. So that's a question. Let that question linger this week, and we'll come back to continue talking. The nature of faith, faith demands a mystery. What if God, the further you go, is about deepening, and that there's more questions, and that his answer to you is deepening mystery and more questions? Heavenly Father, we thank you for those who have gone before us, all kinds of people who have somewhat charted. We're privileged to somewhat live at this point, that we have all this Bible knowledge, all these computer programs, the different languages laid out for us, so many books. There's more books and writing coming out, things. We live in a privileged moment we sometimes forget. And we're thankful for all those who've walked before us and who've somewhat mapped the journey and said, man, these seem to be some identifiable stages. This is what, if you want to live a life of love, if you want to grow in deeper union with God, if you want to be all love and humility, then this seems to be the path that we have to trot. And I pray for all those who are in those stage four moments where there's questions or doubts. We don't seem to hear from you. We want answers. We want you to respond in a certain way, and you don't seem to. And we often like the idea that you're wild and free and uncontrollable until we hit those moments. And so let us ask those questions, that what if you are about deepening that mystery? Will we follow? Do we really have a God who is this massive and huge that he takes on humanity and actually change the whole world, and his love reverberates through all of humankind, and that the resurrection changes humanity as we know it? Do we have that kind of hugeness and bigness? And so we're thankful for what we do know. We could meditate and talk forever on what you have revealed, but it tends to be those things that we don't know that bother us. And so I pray for all of us that that would create, as you did with parables, that eternal itch that keeps us following, that keeps us longing and learning and loving, that that wouldn't send us away, but that that would bring us closer and ever deeper into your mystery. Thank you, and help us to continue to plot our path, and like that mall picture that we able to see, hey, right here, this is where we are, and there's stuff ahead, there's stuff to move forward, there's even difficult stuff too, but the goal is we want to know you. We want to know and love people more. We want to live that life of love, humility, in union. So help us as we walk through the different stages of life.